That's good. I'll point it to you. Put this one on too. Because I'd like to have a backup.
That's fine.
So. Great. Yeah. So if you just, sort of say this about why you wanted to write the pamphlet and your motivations for it, I suppose.
Well, I can't remember actually not having thought about it for quite, I was thinking about those ideas for quite some time. The whole thing started when I was a councillor, actually. The whole thought process started when I was a local councillor. And I used to think, what is the purpose of my surgery? But I just knew that there was something important about it because, not because, like, look, people used to come and see you about damp in their social housing or the inability of the council's finance department to process their council tax properly. Actually, the reason why they came to see their MP was not because they couldn't have achieved the same aim in the end themselves. They felt like they had been treated with disrespect. And almost just the act of my listening and saying, yes, that is not good enough and you are right to be cross, restored something to them, whether or not I could fix the actual problem. It wasn't an operational process that was important to them. It was their self-respect and their dignity that mattered. Mm-hmm. And that was what I could give them. So I thought, well, why is that so important? Why is restoring somebody's dignity so important? And I kind of, like, I had spent 3 years at university debating these theoretical questions of what mattered more, inequality or absolute poverty or you know, infringement of people's rights. And actually I thought, well, I think most of the kind of grand theories have something to offer here, but there's something practical that practical politics teaches us that just reading about values in books doesn't teach us. So that's where it started. And then, yeah, you kind of, you get into opposition and you think, right, okay, well, we have to have something to say about, you know, the fact that we believe in government, you know, progressives believe in the power of government to change people's lives, but if the act of government leaves people feeling worse rather than better, then that's got to be fixed. How do we fix that? Okay, well, the first thing we've got to do is work out what we're trying to do. And that is where your values come in. So you need to think about what your values drive you towards and then how do you make that practically real. And I do think that the person-centred approach that Andy Burnham's talked about and whole person care is a good, a really good way into what I'm talking about, which is saying targets are important, process is important, making sure you've got excellent operational finance is really important. But in addition to that, you've got to look at the person's experience of what you're trying to do. So if you take a job centre, for example, it's not enough to have a well-accounted for process if people leave the job centre feeling worse than they went in, because being unemployed, being useless to our economy, which is what being unemployed actually is one of the worst things that can happen to you, to offend your sense of self-esteem. So what the government does with those people who are in that matters crucially to the health of our economy and whatever else, but it also matters to people's sense of self. So let's try and operationalise that. Let's try and give people a better view of themselves, not a worse view of themselves. And that runs right through the operation of local authorities, you know, DWP as a whole. I think there's a whole way of looking at changing public services by thinking about people's experience of our public services.
Yeah, and their relationships with the different people they
Exactly, because dignity is important in two respects. Firstly, your sense of self-esteem, how you feel about yourself, whether or not you consider yourself to be a dignified person. But it's not just about having rights. It's also about your quality of relationships. So you stand in a relation of dignity to other people in the community if you can look each other in the eyes and feel that there's an equality there, what we would call solidarity, I suppose. So there's this kind of dual thing about making people feel good about themselves and empowered, but also having a relationship of equals with the people around them. That, to me, that two-sided, idea is what dignity really means. And that shakes out practically, like, so often. How often have you knocked a door and somebody's talked to you about, the experience of the receptionist at their local GP, and they just felt that person, didn't care two hoots about the problem or whatever? Well, that's not good enough, is it? Because that person's been made to feel worse, not better. And there's an unequal power relationship there that's got to be dealt with. So I think if we could have a sort of, like, I suppose my language is like a dignitarian state where people respected each other and also cared about how the processes they designed made relationships between people more productive, of better quality, then I think we would have a more progressive government. I think we would have a more successfully interventionist government.
Yeah. I think, as I said, I found that sort of really interesting, and particularly with the, I was thinking about how it kind of then works at the sort of practical level, because the sort of, I suppose, the balance between the sort of the empirical of targets and you can achieve X, Y, Z, and then kind of your like relational sort of emotional side of things are sort of different but complementary, but how you sort of measure one and measure the other and make sure they're being enforced is...
So
enforced sounds like an awful word, enforcing like a...
So
what the relationships
are. Okay, well look, the private sector knows about this. So the private sector knows it has to be emotionally intelligent with its customers. And I'm not somebody who thinks that purely aping the private sector is much good for public services. I don't think marketisation is the answer to everything. However, what the private sector does do is measure its customers' experience of its services. And one thing that I've seen on the ground in my local hospital is a big move towards trying to measure the experience of patients. So getting that instant feedback of how did that go for you? How did it feel? Did we meet your expectations? The measures that the job centre has currently for kind of the experience of its service is like, did we give you the right information at the right time? Well, that's good enough, but it doesn't go anywhere near far enough to understanding what the particular pathway that person took through the job centre and DWP was. We can do much more on that. If you think about it from the employee's perspective as well, like, I don't know, having worked in a big kind of national company, our staff survey every year was an absolute crucial measure as to how well the company was doing. And, do the public have much consciousness of, the staff surveys that are done of NHS staff or DWP staff? Like, no, but I think they should do much more. Like, how well do we measure the experience of, yes, people who use public services, but also the people within them?
Yeah.
Because, constant change and all that all takes an impact. And if you're somebody who thinks that, your job is always going to change every 5 minutes, I don't think that feeling of instability will help you treat the people that you're faced with well, because instead of being focused on them, you're focused on the kind of internal reorganisation that's happening behind you. So I think there are experience measures that can be added to service delivery measures that can help. The other thing that's really important is clear statements of values. So in my pamphlet, I point to the National Pensioners Convention's Dignity Code.
Yeah.
That's a really good example. Say what we all believe. Express it. I think that's really helpful. Organisations that have clear statements of values and behaviours do so because they think you can't just take it as read, that everybody knows what's good enough for us. I mean, you know, that's... It's a very common thing in kind of organisations that we become a part of. So, you know, I think of scouts and guides or football clubs or, you know, we say what we believe and that helps to make it real. Well, why don't we do that in the public sector? I mean, they probably do to a certain extent, but is it done in a way that their staff believe in it? Does it shine through? I'm not always sure it does. So, yeah, there's kind of statements of belief, I think, are really important.
Yeah. I think two things just coming out of that. I mean, when I read the pamphlet and you used the example of the job centres, I immediately thought of something one of my friends said, which was, you know, when you go into sort of people's experience of a job centre will be, like, probably the majority of the time negative. But if you use a recruitment agency, you come away from that conversation thinking, like, you know, you're capable of anything, and they make you feel, you know, incredibly empowered and like you can get that job. So, you know, like you said, not kind of actually trying to imitate the private sector, but sort of learning things from that is...
Yeah, learn something from that. The some bits of the job centre can be empowering and good. So sector-based work academies where companies work collaboratively with the job centre to set up a kind of pre-interview like day where people learn more about their work, and they kind of basically set up a little mini job centre for that company. It works best if you've got a big organisation that's arriving in a town and they know they're going to need, you know, a new supermarket, they know that they're going to need X number of staff, and the job centre can help them fill those vacancies, but do so in a proactive way, not just stick a note up and see who comes in through the door, but, you know, target the recipients of that information. They then come in, meet with that employer informally, you know, understand much more about the job. Those are all the sorts of things that recruitment agencies do, but the job centre also has good experience in, because often when, you know, in a place like where I'm from in Merseyside, where it's like big employers in manufacturing or what have you, now often retail, you know, big dominant employers, the job centre is used to kind of needing to deal with what happens when a big employer closes or what have you. So they're quite, operationally can be really good at that.
Yeah.
However, the reality is that in the recession, what a lot of people saw was the thing that I would argue the job centre is less good at, which is what happens when you turn up when the worst has happened. And, you know, at that point, people need reassurance and information. You know, most people don't spend a great deal of time on job seekers allowance. I think I'm right in saying that the average is something like, or like a significant number of people, I can't remember the statistic exactly, but a significant number of people have moved off JSA within 6 months. Like, maybe we should start telling people these things. You know, as I say, what most people need is information and reassurance. Wow. Even if you just went out of the job centre with a clutch of other organisations that could help you, rather than, by and large, than just checking for fraud, which is really, really important that they do that, but it can't be the only thing that they do. Again, lone parent advisors, something that under Labour the job centre did extremely well. Like, our performance on helping lone parents back into work was really good because we had dedicated individuals who were expert at helping that group, and there was a real sense of reward for those advisors because they got to know the people they were working with. They saw them before they had to go back into work, so they built up that relationship and they could talk to them about the different opportunities, how they were going to manage childcare. It's a rewarding thing to do, whereas if the process is just really set out for you and all you've got to do is ask people very set questions, you know, box-ticking culture where people have just got to make sure that they go through the very tightly drawn process, and that's what they know. They're not interested in that person. It's just tick the box when the computer tells you to. Then I think inevitably people are going to feel that. Yeah. They're going to feel that advisor wasn't interested in them as a person. They were only interested in if they ticked the right box. They'd filled in their job search thing correctly. Well, you know, it's dehumanising.
Yeah.
And is that what we want for people who are going through a life crisis? Losing your job is, or, you know, being young and not having a job is a crisis for anybody in their life. Do we want to send them into a world where basically that person is checking that they've ticked the box correctly? No, I don't think anybody thinks that's right. We've got to have proper procedures in place so that we know that public money is being spent correctly. As well as that, we've got to have a way of treating people like human beings.
Yeah, and that's all about the kind of the cultural shift that
we need.
Going back a little bit, I suppose thinking about sort of these, how you sort of change the culture in an organisation, but also the, I completely lost my train of thought now, how you change that culture or the sort of the feeling of insecurity at a time of like economic insecurity. So at the moment, like say, you know, we actually win in 2015, like that actually happens, and then, you know, we want to kind of begin to do, you know, say, you know, your idea gets taken up and we take this forward. How can we begin to kind of make sure that people, you know, making people feel more secure in their job? In, like, even in the private sector, which is something you talked about, like, that kind of insecurity is kind of a macro thing that you can't really...
So in a world of huge change, what is reliable?
Yeah, kind of, how do you bring that kind of... Because it is about sort of being positive and that sort of hope and promise and of the relationships.
Yeah.
How can you sort of drive that forward when, cause, you know, we're going to, like, you know, if we win, we're going to have to make incredibly drastic and horrible cuts, which I think not enough people are prepared for. Those kind of things.
Or at the very least, the situation that they will leave us will be pretty bad. Local authorities have already dealt with horrific and horrendous cuts. And I think Andy Sawford said some stuff just recently about what we might do to kind of address some of that. But what they've already done has put people in a really difficult position. Even if we didn't have a difficult financial situation to manage, which we will do, what they've already done is bad enough. So, the reason for setting down what I think a values-led approach might be is partly because I think probably the one constant is your values. And that is reliable. So I think you can definitely give people that. My whole sort of approach in this pamphlet is basically predicated on the idea that there isn't a penny more to spend. So if there's not a penny more to spend, what can you change within what we currently, you know, how can you change the way in which this money is spent, even if you can't change a single, you know, penny piece of it? And I think that you entirely properly could spend the money that we spend on Job Centre quite differently. You know, without committing any more, just changing in which people are treated, I think could make a massive difference.
I don't know who he is, my friend.
But how do you give people a sense of stability?
I'll pop down by your chance and see.
Politics, I suppose, is not always helpful in this, because one of the things that you often pick up from you know, I remember when I was kind of working for Network Rail, and the rail industry over the years, like an industry that, like, my dad worked in, my grandma, you know, like, I know the rail industry pretty well, and when I was there, you so often felt the politics of the problem, not the answer to anything. And that lesson, like, really stayed with me, and I think it's partly the answer to this is about how we act as politicians and not treating those people who work for us as part of the government disrespectfully by acting high-handedly. I mean, one of the things that I suppose people in the NHS most resent about the reorganisation is, even if they really resent the proposals, it's the high-handedness with which it's been done. So I think you can say two things about instability and insecurity. First one is about an expression of values, that even in a time of great change in technology and financially, you know, the structure of our kind of finances is changing, you can say, well, these are our values, and that is the rock on which we stand.
Mm-hmm.
The second thing that I think you can say is about how you'll behave, and you know, about properly listening to people and properly giving them time to be understood. I think that you can always afford.
Yeah.
It doesn't cost anything to be polite and listen to people.
Yeah. And that's something that you can sort of diffuse through just the tone of an organisation and how...
Absolutely.
From the highest level.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, the best public servants that I've worked with, you know, from a kind of politician... kind of civil servant, whether that's in local government or national, the best that I've worked with have been the ones that are truly prepared to listen to every single member of staff. Example, in my local hospital, when I went to see one of the best wards, one of the reasons I knew was because the medical director of that bit of the service introduced me to their cleaner, who was going to show me around, because... number one, so that I didn't forget to do the gel thing and all the rest of it. But he said that they'd fought really hard to maintain their own kind of cleaning staff and the head cleaner,
yeah,
because they felt that was so crucial to the kind of safety of what they did, and that that person had a real power over everybody who worked there to maintain standards. And so she was going to show me around because she knew everybody in the department. You know, that this was somebody who had all the power, who'd basically... you know, effectively handed it over to a member of their staff who in many other cases would have been quite junior or even contracted out.
Yeah. And that's really a nice heartening example.
Yeah, yeah, it was really good. It's really good.
Yeah. That's good. Because my mum works, she's a community occupational therapist.
Right.
So she's one of those people who absolutely, like, she loves the day-to-day of her job,
yeah,
like going and sort of dealing with patients and stuff, but has had the kind of, you know, I remember, like, 97 being like, you know, she was like, oh, you know, labour.
Yeah.
And then sort of everything getting better, and she's like, oh, you know, we've got more money. And it was sort of, like, the top-down,
yeah,
reorganisation was always, like, a thing, because, like, oh, you know, it was another manager or something.
Yeah.
But, like, in the last 3 years, and just like, you know.
Does she work for an NHS trust?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
In Staffordshire, so...
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm going to do a kind of back-to-the-floor, like, day at work with our... local authorities team that gets people out of hospital.
Okay.
So I imagine some of those will be OTs.
Yeah.
On Friday, and it's really interesting. Actually, one of the, you know, the whole public NHS debate is actually about GPs and surgeons and what have you, and people just totally forget that actually the way that most people interact with the NHS is like with occupational therapists or midwives or,
yeah,
health, you know, this like whole kind of forgotten bit of our health service, which is in some ways like the most important. It's like the preventative bit as well.
Yeah,
that, you know,
absolutely. And they're just like equally as affected by all the kind of cuts to funding and everything. And but just, yeah, thinking about the kind of the culture of an organisation, and, you know, she's had sort of terrible managers for, like, you know, huge areas, and she just, you know, just really do kind of bring down
So my question is this, right? The whole reason I wrote the pamphlet is like, what would it be like if services like that were well run in a way that your mom went to work and felt that she was well supported, she had the tools to do her job, she felt that the people running the service understood what she needed to give a good job to the people that she works with every day?
Yeah.
What would that do? So if she felt like that the infrastructure helped her get her job done well, rather than she gets her job done well despite whatever the, you know, politics is going on.
Yeah.
You know, what would that be like? That would be amazing.
Yeah.
And, you know, I kind of believe that it's possible to do that without thinking about spending a single penny more.
Yeah, just instilling those kind of...
just having the right values.
Yeah.
And most people do have the right values. That's the thing I really think, that most people do have are good. You know, not, there'll always be the odd one who, you know, for whatever reason gets it absolutely wrong, but most people want to get up every day and do a good job for the public.
Yeah.
So what can we do to have an underpinning that helps them do that?
Yeah.
Set out our values and then, you know, act like it.
Yeah.
I think what we have to do.
Definitely. Yeah, it's just like, it's sort of the underlying public service, you know, that attitude. Yeah. I mean, regardless of anywhere else, but, you know, all my mum talks about how, like, her immediate colleagues are, you know, fantastic and, like, lovely, brilliant people, and then it's just kind of the structure that, like, weighs them down and having, you know, three different, like, ways to kind of do your admin. So, you know, it's like tablet, computer, handwritten notes, and everything's just awful and, like, takes up more of her time than anything else. So.
Yeah. One of the interesting things about DWP and the Job Centre is that I did a day, kind of back to the floor again, with the Job Centre, and one of the things that really struck me was the computers they were using were really old and really slow.
Yeah.
And there's a thing called the better off calculation, which is really, really important, because we decided that what we would do for every lone parent initially, and then we rolled it out, I think, was talk people through how they would be better off. So you go through what they're currently getting.
Okay, so it's like a face-to-face.
Yeah, so it's face-to-face, and you sit, the advisor sits with the person that they're working with, and they go through, okay, you currently get your JSA, housing benefit, and whatever else, right? And that's this much per week or per month. And then they would go through, okay, so here's, take this job, here's the wage rate you get, you know, if they're eligible for tax credits on top of that, and blah, 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 and that's the amount at the end of the month.
Mm.
And therefore, they could see that they were better off, because a lot of people, especially if you're long-term unemployed or a lone parent or whatever, a lot of people, it can be a massive risk to go into work if they're worried about losing all kinds of things, and therefore, they're not, it's not that they wouldn't be better off, it's just that they're not certain.
Yeah.
And actually, that uncertainty can be the barrier. So you have to have a way in. Now, when I was sat with the advisor there, person doing a great job and everything, but the computer was quite old, and actually the technology hadn't updated. So they kept having to say to me, oh, well, okay, it says that, but actually the government have just cut that job grant. And, oh, and the rates for this haven't been updated yet with the new rates after, you know, the benefit uprating, whatever. So they were having to, like, back calculate mentally what it, well, that's no good, is it? Like, if you don't give the person the tools to do the job, then you can't do it. So actually making sure that infrastructure works well to make sure that the people at the front line are getting the job done, I think, is something that we miss all the time.
Mm.
And makes people feel a bit like they're unimportant.
Yeah, it's like you have to jump through all these hoops just to kind of get the actual bit of your job that makes a difference, where you're interacting with someone and giving them like a meaningful kind of service.
Yeah.
So, going back to jobs and stuff, I was also, this is a slight shift to the politics of solutions.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, proudly a progress thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was reading a chapter, and that was sort of, because that's sort of more about actually, you know, the solutions rather than the sort of, you know, ideological or sort of values-based underpinning.
Yeah.
And the sort of the thing that struck me in particular was sort of on the kind of Job Centre Plus bit about, you know, how job centres can work at the sort of local level, and you sort of talked about it a bit when you said how they work in like the Wirral. But sort of how much do you think that sort of devolving power to sort of how much is devolving power necessary?
It's necessary because
it's something we sort of talk, sorry, it's something we talk about a lot. Yeah. Like we kind of like saying, oh yeah, you know, give like local authorities power and empowering people, but I don't know, this is just kind of a general thought I have. Like, we always say it's a good in itself.
So here's why it's necessary. I don't think it's good just because it is. I think that it's good because of how the economy works. So basically, markets cluster. So what I mean by that is the administrative boundaries of government are not the same as the boundaries of operational markets in the UK. this is an important fact that is not always recognised by politics and politicians. So oftentimes politicians will get hung up on the boundaries of administration that they, so like, you know, I'm sure I've been guilty of this, getting obsessed about what goes on within a parliamentary constituency, but actually most people don't think in those terms.
Yeah.
But so city regions should be the effective economy that is kind of operational. So we have a kind of manufacturing cluster in the northwest where businesses have kind of grouped together for sensible reasons of the economy. So there's like lots of bits of automotive industry in a particular area because they operate better when they're closer to each other. Like, why is there a sort of creative, artistic community in Hackney? Because those people want to hang out together. That's how it works, right? And, you know, like, so the global CEO of Unilever, massive international company, came and had dinner in my constituency. Not so that he could have dinner with me, but so that he could hang out with the, like, amazingly brilliant scientific community that's in Liverpool University, right, and in Darsbury, in Derek Twigg's constituency, right, because they're doing brilliant scientific things between the scientists within Unilever, the guys at the science park in Darsbury, and Liverpool University, right. That is a cluster that is working together economically to make things and sell things and to do leading edge technology that is there because the geography of that economy means that they want to hang out together. That's how economies work, right? We've got to recognise that with how we operate administratively. So where does the best intelligence lie as to how to tackle unemployment? I'm not sure that the best intelligence lies within DWP. I think it lies probably more likely within local authorities and kind of city region operations because that's how the economy works. So if you want, who made the best of the Olympics coming to London? Well, thankfully the Labour administrations of the London boroughs like Newham worked out what their local unemployment was like and how to best interact as government to tackle that unemployment using the opportunity of the Olympics. It wasn't like national government coming up with a DWP procedure that would be rolled out nationally, like, because that's just not how economies work, right? So the unemployment that exists in the north end of Birkenhead or the north of Liverpool is radically different from the unemployment that exists in East London. So why would we expect to have a national government department have one answer to both of those things? It just doesn't work like that. It just doesn't operate like that. So it's, to me, it's devolution of power for an absolutely clear purpose. In the end, it comes back to understanding the people that you're working with and understanding the people that you're there to serve. As it happens, I think probably local authorities are better placed to be in the lead on. It doesn't mean central government doesn't have a supporting role, but in the end, local authorities are better placed to be in the lead than central government. And that's why you have to do the devolution, I think. Mm. Which, you know, Liam and now Rachel have done a huge amount of work on how you could do that and what, you know, how you make kind of, I suppose, how you make a kind of real concerted attempt to deal not just with the kind of cyclical unemployment that happened because of the recession, but also, you know, a kind of route back to full employment.
And you think things like elected mayors and sort of, you know, greater, actually devolving greater sort of power in that way to sort of city regions or wherever, a kind of a step towards doing that.
Yeah, I don't get hung up on structures. I mean, I am definitely a kind of, I don't think that mayors are a good end in themselves. I don't think anybody's ever really thought that. But I do think that what I heard from the business community in Merseyside for quite some time was they wanted a leadership that would go and fight for our city and maintain the economic momentum that Liverpool as a city region has seen, and they felt that having clear lines of political leadership was a way to do that, and I think I would probably agree. Doesn't mean, I don't think they need to have the job title of mayor. I mean, there's other people who aren't mayors but who are leaders of councils who do it perfectly competently and who have a kind of view that their responsibilities, you know, don't just stop at the boundary of their particular administration, but have a kind of view over the whole economy. You know, they care about the places the people they represent work, not just where they live, and I think that's really important. So you don't just need to be a mayor to do it, but there was a definite view coming out of Merseyside, I would say, especially out of the community there, that we want clear political leadership for our city region. And I think, you know, thankfully we have that, not just in the mayor of Liverpool City, but also, you know, the leader of Wirral Council, Phil Davis, has been important in having that city region, city-wide view as well.
Yeah. It's having made a really strong kind of local... Yeah, it's like you said, it's like people... And it all links into relationship stuff, is that people understand what's going on at the ground. And
Can
communicate that sort of...
Absolutely, absolutely.
Backwards and forwards.
Yeah.
And how much... Sorry, I'm just aware of time and how much...
I'm fine.
You're okay?
I'm fine.
Good.
Yeah.
I don't want to, like, kind of keep...
That's
asking
okay.
you more if you're not, if you push. But
I might need some cake at some point, but probably not.
That's a perfectly good news.
Yeah.
So I thought kind of would shift a bit now towards what like your new role is on the Shadow Diffid team. And I suppose maybe just say a bit about kind of the challenges or the kind of opportunities of your new role and the particular work you're doing.
Okay. It's interesting because international development is something that I've cared about sort of for a long time. I think Oxfam was probably the first charity that I ever like gave money to. And I really remember deciding to do that. After I'd studied economics at Birkbeck, I thought briefly about kind of studying further in sort of development economics and what have you, and it didn't happen because I became a local councillor. went from the global to the local, but it's something that I've really passionately cared about and was on the select committee, so I feel like a round peg in a round hole, which is not always, you know, not always the case for, you know, lots of reasons. Like, people end up kind of having briefs that aren't always that, but so it's an amazing privilege in that sense. You know, to a certain extent, you get all this kind of hate about international aid and what have you that comes from a certain corner of Parliament and a certain group of people. I think the vast majority of the British public feel a sense of, you know, they don't want desperate extreme poverty in the world, and they want to feel as though we do our bit. Actually, the world is changing though, and there's a lot of opportunities for Africa. You know, all the work that Tony Blair and Gordon Brown did to encourage African leadership, in my view, you know, that has moved the agenda on, and we need to talk about kind of what our trading relationship might look like with countries like Nigeria and Kenya and other places, certainly in India and Bangladesh. But that's bringing with it a responsibility on us, I think, to look at what the standards are we expect, you know, in places like in the garment industry in Bangladesh and now Cambodia. Wage levels are a real issue, health and safety is a massive issue. and that's something where I think, you know, the labour movement has a very important role. Our historic role has been one of solidarity with trade union movement in other countries, and I think we have a role to say to people in Britain, look, you know, we have this massively significant trading relationship with poorer countries. You know, on every British high street we walk down, we buy our clothes, you know, we buy goods made in poorer countries. I think most people don't want to do that without a knowledge of a certain standard, that there's not child labour involved, that people have a safe environment to work in. I think those are their big issues now that we've got to tackle. One of the first acts of the Tory government was to defund the International Labour Organization, which is the UN-sponsored body championing workplace rights and health and safety and wages. You know, that tells you all you need to know, I think, on this agenda. And I think there's a huge opportunity to engage with British people and say, you know, you look around you, you know, we buy all kinds of things from poorer countries. Let's make sure that that money that we spend, not, you know, forget for a minute, important though it is, forget for a minute the money we give through our taxes. Let's just think for a minute about the money we give when we buy stuff in the shops. You know, doesn't everybody want to know that they're buying things that are made safely, where people have been reimbursed properly for their labour? I think most people do. So there are things that we can do to make sure that that happens, and one of which is working with our partners in the labour movement to strengthen those campaigns in countries like Bangladesh and Cambodia.
Yeah.
You know, I'm also really interested in fair trade and how we develop that. You know, the kind of pump priming of fair trade as an idea, and the development of that, I think, was a success of the last Labour government. Can that be replicated? Can we, you know, bring that kind of business model into more lines that we see in Europe?
Yeah,
I think that's worth looking at.
Yeah, because it is one of those things where you felt like a shift in the last sort of 10 years, is the fact that, you know, like some supermarkets have, like, you know, a certain range will always be all fair trade, and it's like it is. I think it is one of those things. I'm always a bit sort of wary of being like, oh, we can just educate the public and everything will be fine. Like, you know, not at all. But, you know, when people know that, you know, buying a fair trade banana.
Yeah. But when you've got Primark on the telly saying that they're calling on other retailers to sign up to the Bangladesh Safety Accords, you know, this is not about saying, oh, people just need to pay more for everything. It's about saying, actually, you know, you've already got a company that's known for its kind of cheap prices, saying other retailers need to kind of sign up to the work that the ILO are doing to make sure that this stuff is made safely. I don't think... Actually, I don't think that, you know, we should just expect people to radically change their behaviour, but I do think we can say to them, look, join us in a campaign to make sure that whatever we buy, there's a certain level of standard. And if you choose to invest in a product that is made to a higher standard because there's, you know, some ethical parameters there, and, you know, there's a premium that goes to the communities that make that to help them invest for the long term in stuff like health and education, then I think we can give people both the comfort of a standard about how things are made, and also a choice about making a, you know, a sort of more ethical investment if they want to. The big fight, I think, is less about educating the public and more just saying to them, like, we already have this trading relationship, so let's make it work for poorer countries. You know, you don't need to do anything radically different, just make the kind of organisations kind of live up to the standards that you think that they should.
Yeah, and using the leaves of power that we have, like be it sort of, yeah. you know, in government or, you know, as a member of the public signing a petition.
Yeah, exactly. But I go back to this thing about the choices that the Tories have made. You know, I don't... When the Bangladesh awful factory fire happened at Rana Plaza last year, the very organisation that has organised the response to that and has liaised with the garment workers union there and the European and American brands to try and make sure that there's a proper response to that huge loss of life of over 1,000 people. That's the very organisation that the Tories defunded. So I don't think we should let them get off scot-free, but equally I think, you know, we as a party and as a movement have a good story to tell the British public on how we can respond to kind of a changing global world and, you know, work on making sure that whilst world trade increases, it does so in a way that is equitable and fair.
Yeah. And so you don't think then that, I mean, this is probably sort of what you're talking about when you have that kind of, you know, the part of the Tory party that says people don't want to kind of, you know, aren't interested in funding other people's development in other countries because, you know, it's things are tough at home.
My constituents tell me that charity begins at home, but it does not end there. Yeah. That's what most people with an ounce of common sense, I think, in Britain think.
Yeah. It's a sounding message.
Yeah.
The other thing I wanted to ask you about in the kind of development sort of frame was the Global Early Years petition that Tessa and Ivan sort of launched at conference.
Yeah.
And I mean, I don't like, I sort of followed it when it was launched, but I don't know what's happening now and kind of what the next steps are or what the knife joint. That's fine. I just, it's one of those things.
I'm sure we're really behind it.
Yeah, I just thought it was an interesting idea, but it's part of reshuffling, I imagine, everything kind of is going.
Sorry?
The Global Early Years Petition. I can't. Is that me or Gav? I guess it's sort of me. Mm. The sort of wider context. Yeah, please don't drop me in it.
Don't worry, I'm not going.
Fabian magazine. The bigger sort of question is like, what do you replace the Millennium Development Goals with? Mm. I mean, point number one that always has to be repeated is we are unlikely to hit all the Millennium Development Goals. Yeah. I mean, we'll make some, but not all of them. And one of the most off track, one of the sort of least met is maternal mortality. Mm. So there needs to be a huge effort to make sure that even if we don't meet that it's not never forgotten about and that those efforts are continued. But there is a question about, you know, what does the new framework under which everybody kind of moves forward together look like? And as you know, we've got some ideas of that about that, and I know Jim's really up for that kind of global leadership role.
Yeah. It's exciting.
Yeah.
I'll keep my ears tuned.
Yeah. Don't tell Tessa, I didn't know what was
going on. It's fine. So then, like, moving on a bit from development stuff and a bit more kind of the general, like, political outlook.
Yeah.
And sort of, again, talking about challenges, sort of what do you think the biggest challenge for Labour is kind of going into the election next year?
Well... the Tories will always try to outspend us. Yeah. And, you know, that's what the Tory party does. We have a brilliant activist base, and Ed has kind of presided over this massive increase in organisers and, you know, organising... as an idea, and I think that's phenomenal. So we have to kind of respond to this like attack that's going to come in terms of their trying to spend their way into government. I think that's, you know, I think that is always a challenge, but I don't get any sense in my constituency that people aren't up for the fight. Just the opposite. You know, I have lost count of the number of times in Wirral in the past, you know, over the kind of Christmas and New Year period, that people have sort of, you know, wished me very well and hoped that we'll see a change of government. You know, that's there's a real spirit out there looking for it. So we have to mobilise and organise and make sure that we take the fight to them.
Yeah. And what, I mean, you sort of mentioned, like, you know, how sort of has built up, like, the sort of the organising base in the party. And one of my kind of, which I don't think I'm unique in having this perspective, but, like, on organising is that, like, it's amazing to get so many people, like, involved and empowered in a campaign and kind of politically active, and there's, like, all these incredible stories about, you know, people sort of affecting change in their community. And I suppose I sit in between, like, the kind of, like, voter ID, we need to know where our vote is, and, like, community organising is going to win us the election. They obviously do work together because we're sort of doing both at the moment anyway.
Yeah.
But, like, the question is, like, how can we be sure that by doing a sort of building community organising, that, you know, these people are actually then going to, like, vote for us?
I spent some time with Arnie Graff, who is the most wonderful person, and just a joy to He really is. And one of the things that I most love about him is the respect that he shows to Labour Party organisers. I have a huge amount of time for the people who diligently toil for our movement within the Labour Party, often with little public thanks, you know, sometimes the opposite. So, and Arnie kind of, I think, sees the immense intelligence that there is in, you know, the kind of Labour Party organising staff. It's very easy, I think, sometimes to get in politics, to get sucked into the glamour of, not that it is very glamorous, but to get sucked into the glamour of standing close to powerful people.
Yeah.
It's much harder to be passionate and committed when you've spent, you know, 5 weeks in Pendle in the rain, you know, getting people out, knocking on doors, talking to people. You know, it's very easy to sit in SW1 and agonise about the language that, you know, in some press release or op-ed. It's much harder to expend shoe leather and to have those, you know, difficult conversations on the doorstep and to know the right words to say on the doorstep.
Yeah.
So I think Arnie's rightly put the focus where it should be, which is on the doorstep. However, I'm absolutely also passionate about running good elections that are effective and that win. I've stood in 2 elections, both of which about the result was very uncertain. And, you know, I think we have to have the most effective election campaign that we can possibly, and that means, you know, having an effective operation that engages with the public. I don't think the two things are mutually exclusive at all, actually. I think the focus on organising has just got to be this kind of spirited attempt to make sure that people are rightly thinking about the most important conversation that the Labour Party has, which is the one between our activists and our politicians and the public, you know, in person. In, you know, there's a sort of, there's a hierarchy of conversations that you have, and the best one that you can have with the public is person to person, and the next best one that you can have is on the phone, and the next best one is the one that you have on paper, you know, a letter sent to them. The one after that is a leaflet pushed through the door, and, you know, that's where we should be focused, in that hierarchy. And I think that the focus on organising has really driven that.
Yeah. I suppose
that answer.
Yeah, yeah. I suppose, and it's also part of, you know, thinking about the way which you organise is, and, you know, I just think about, like, when I went out the weekend, and the organiser was kind of, it's always the most kind of discreet person there, but that's kind of is managing everything, and that probably doesn't, you know, never seems to get that much thanks. And we'll do something like nice, like bring a box of chocolates or...
Yeah.
And I suppose that's a, you know, all relates to kind of sort of organisational culture and how we treat people in our party as well, as, you know, thinking about the value stuff. And
right, absolutely. You know, so
if,
like,
we're not doing it at home in the Labour Party, then...
Exactly. So, absolutely. So be good to people, you know, within the Labour Party, like... Like, that sort of approach of treating people well, talking to them, listening to them, caring about them as a person. Like, we've got to do that in the Labour Party.
Yeah.
You know, and absolutely. That's,
yeah, it's such a important experience. I think for anyone who's kind of involved in the party, like, there are people who kind of get involved and it sort of goes well. They just persist and find nice people. But so often, like, you know, I think... You know, most people we meet are like, oh yeah, my first experience with the Labour Party was awful. I was sort of dumped in the middle of a council estate with a bunch of leaflets and didn't know where to go. Or, you know, it was like, you know, a brunch meeting with a group of old white guys over 50. Like,
yeah. I'm so lucky in that regard because my first, it wasn't quite my first experience of Labour Party campaigning, but it was an early one. In Southwark when I moved there after I finished university, and my first kind of real experience was I'm not sure it was my first, so let me say it was an early one because otherwise, like, somebody will, like, recall some of them. Anyway, I turned up to a campaigning session not necessarily knowing what it was all about, and I was met by Kirsty McNeill, and I'm not sure if Rodri Thomas was there as well, but anyway, you know, Kirsty sort of says to me, right, we're doing this petition about improving social housing, and like, the quality of the housing was really bad, you know, so everyone wanted to sign our petition. And so I met somebody who's since become, like, a brilliant and wonderful and amazing friend, and we were door knocking about an issue that could not be more important, and everybody wanted to hear about it and sign up to it. You know, I can say that not all campaign sessions for the Labour Party since have been as good. But in that sense, you know, I suppose I was quite lucky. The lesson that I always, thinking back to that experience, the lesson I took from it was, you know, be good to each other, be nice to each other. And as colleagues within the party, try and treat each other with a bit of care. And secondly, you know, go to people with an issue that is important to them, that they care about, and go and talk to them and ask them to join your campaign. And if you know, if you've got the issue right, and if you're prepared to expend time and effort, they will.
What would be, like, your most kind of, one of your most, like, successful or memorable examples of that, where you've, like, engaged someone and, I don't know, got them involved in the campaign or got them to, like, join the party or, like...
Well, interestingly enough, or I don't know if it's interesting, but anyway, so my big campaign lesson at the moment, I mean, from my constituency, is without a doubt care. So... I, at the time, I have since at the time, no one in my family had needed social care of any kind, or, you know, care in their home, nothing at all in that vein. And I didn't know anything about it, and I hadn't even thought about it as a political issue in run up to the 2010 general election. I mean, I'd written my kind of material on jobs and unemployment, even though, like, Merseyside actually did much better through the recession than anyone thought we would. The consciousness of unemployment is always quite high for reasons you can imagine. And I'd written all the stuff about, you know, regeneration and blah, blah, blah. And I thought, you know, I'm from my constituency, born and raised. I know every paving stone. My family live there. My mates live there. I thought I knew it all. How wrong you can be, right? Because I kept knocking on doors and people kept saying, the biggest issue I've got is my dad's got Alzheimer's and the council just keep sending, you know, a different social worker every 5 minutes. We keep going off sick, or, oh, and I just couldn't find a carer. And then I did get a company, and, you know, the carer who came was not even getting paid for travel time. And so they were so stressed. And I was like, oh my goodness, care is a massive issue. And then someone I know really well in my local party had been caring for two older relatives and was like, yeah, this is like a really big thing. You know, where have you been? And so we've run this big campaign on care and, like, you know, bringing sort of the dignity aspect, actually, you know, ethical care, and what does that look like, and how do we treat people with dignity and what have you. And I knew nothing about it, and I would not have thought about it at all had I not knocked doors. If I'd not taken the time to listen to people and say, just out of interest, what's the biggest issue to you, you know, just, I would have never thought of it. And as a result, we've had public meetings, you know, public meetings of a Friday evening. Who wants to go out then? You know, there's good stuff on the telly, right? So, but really well attended public meetings where people have taken time out to come and tell me about their experience, because it really matters to them. And we've had loads of people involved, and I would have never have known about it if I hadn't just asked people. It's been a huge lesson to me that we think we know, you know, you think as a politician, oh, I know what the issues are, you know, I can write a good leaflet. You haven't got a clue unless you've asked people.
Yeah, and that's like the most quality interaction is when you actually...
Yeah, exactly. You have to talk to people. You have to, like, be a little bit annoying and, like, knock on their door at a time when you think they're going to be in. And you have to ask open-ended questions about what matters to people. You can't just say, you know, can I count on your vote? You have to ask genuinely open-ended questions and be prepared for them to raise anything they want, and, you know, not come at it with your own preconceptions about, I know what's important to people who live in town X or street Y. You have to be prepared for the unexpected.
Yeah, I think the care thing is just like, it is one of those things that always comes up.
Yeah.
And there's always, like, always just a really heartbreaking story.
Yeah, really heartbreaking. Yeah, partly because it's, like, people's mums and dads, nans, grands, aunties, people that are really important to them. And so it's got to be really important to politics, because these are our most profound relationships. Yeah. So how we take care of those people with whom we have the most profound relationships is one of the ways in which we're going to, like, live well as a country or not.
Yeah. I think the stuff we're doing on care is so important. And, yeah. Like,
Liz Kendall is doing, I think, a really important job in being the sort of voice of people who have got caring responsibilities and need care and are therefore less able to engage with the political process. Mm.
Yeah, that's one of the things that always, I think, comes up when you kind of discuss care. It's always the sort of, obviously, like, the person who's being cared for, but, like, the carers themselves.
Yeah.
And I suppose that goes back to what we were saying earlier about insecurity. And they are people who are always insecure because they're having to, you know, pay for their own petrol, or they're on 0 hours contract, or, like, so many things that make it insecure and, like, a really horrible job.
Yeah.
But they're just not, they're so insecure, and yet they're often the most incredible people who, despite all the odds and it being horrific, it just, like...
Unison took me to meet some of their reps, and one of the women there reduced me to tears because... because she was talking about doing palliative care and what it was like to do that. And she was, it was in the context of working with people who were on 0 hours contracts and didn't know if they were going to be getting hours or not next week, and the problems that caused just reliably being able to say who was coming, which is obviously really important. And when she was as she was talking about looking after people who are dying, I can't imagine doing that job.
Yeah.
How hard is that?
Yeah.
And like, these are not well paid people, and we need to totally turn on its head the level of respect that we give to people who do that job.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the people who looked after my nan when she was dying, like, they're just amazing.
Yeah, they're like they're just the best people. Like, when it is, that's it, when it's someone who you love so much and is so vulnerable, and they're like in this sort of, really vulnerable state. And I suppose sort of raising the status of carers, this is something I did like a Young Fabian Policy Commission on care. And one of the things that came up, but that we didn't kind of have a chance to explore, and I know this isn't like your kind of brief or anything, but seeing as you've done stuff about care in your constituency, like, was like how we sort of raise the status of carers, and, you know, how much of that is sort of pay, and because obviously, you know, how much you're paid for your job reflects, you know, I think people feel it's like worthwhile anyway, but to kind of sort of feel that your work is valued, and also make sure that, you know, people can afford to be a carer, like that it's a job that pays them well enough. Because I think you also get, like, on the flip side of amazing carers, you get really terrible carers who don't care. Like, I've got a really good friend who's got really severe cerebral palsy, but is like just really bright and intelligent and brilliant, and he'll just say, you know, they just like, some he gets, you know, agency carers that come in and go, and different ones, and some of them just sort of treat him like, like he doesn't need interaction, he just needs
like
kind of
thick.
Stuff done to him. And so you, on the flip side, you get those people, and is that because it's like a poorly paid
job? I think part of it is about progression. So one of the kind of best moments in going to a local school, like a couple of years ago, was when I met a young person who had been a carer for her mum, and she was studying health and social care, and she wanted to go into the field. She was like fascinated and passionate about it. And she had this ambition to have her own organisation. And I thought, well, that's great. And if people going into that profession felt that it was somewhere where they were going to develop themselves and their skills, and, you know, we just said how highly skilled the people are that work in the field, like, probably what there isn't is much progression. So how many people who go and work in health and social care every year end up being a manager or a senior manager in that field, or going on from there to do a degree in their subject, you know, after a few years decide that they want to specialise or become more qualified in that and work their way up.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know, but, you know, I doubt that it's many. So I think if we could figure out routes of progression, that might be one way in terms of sort of esteem and people feeling like it was an aspirational thing to do. Pay is undoubtedly a part of it, but, you know, we're in this awful situation about having questions about whether people are even getting the minimum wage, never mind a living wage. So there's a lot of work to do there, without thinking about, you know, before you even get to whether we can get properly to a living wage, like, let's make sure people aren't actually breaking the law.
Yeah.
You know, let's enforce the law as it stands, for goodness sake. I've done a lot on 0 hours contracts in the field of care, and I think we were saying before about standards and, like, saying what your values are being important. The Unison Ethical Care Charter is another way that local authorities can do that, so they can say not just about paying a living wage, but also being an ethical care employer, which Wirral is moving towards adopting now, where there's a whole list of things about moving away from 0 hours, 15-minute appointments, treating every person with respect, you know, using their full title if that's what they, you know, Mr. or Mrs. if that's what they want. Or it's a whole list of things, and actually what that enables councils to do is say what their values are.
Yeah.
And I think if you do that, you also say to people who work in that field, we're paying attention here.
Yeah.
We're not just going to dole a contract out, and frankly what happens to you in your workplace is none of our concern as a commissioner. I think commissioners as public bodies have got to say what their values are in that sense, and that also gives people, you know, a sense of esteem about the importance of what they do.
Yeah.
Part of it also is just political attention and politicians saying this really matters to us, and I think that helps, you know, saying to people in that field, you do an amazing job. If there's issues that mean that you're doing less of an amazing job, we need to hear about it.
Yeah. That sounds really like hopeful, that you can kind of...
Yeah,
you know.
I think you can do a lot just by listening to people and...
Yeah.
Try to make sure they understand the value of what they do.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right, like the power, like commissioners do have so much power to kind of, you know, raise standards and say, you know, well, we're not going to take this on if you're not paying the living wage or...
Yeah.
And the way you can sort of, yeah, like bring in, like, you know, the ethics and values of the organisation into that as well.
Yeah.
It's kind of a, not like a soft power thing, but it's a...
Yeah, it's a way of making it clear to the people who are working for you, I suppose, that you do have some values, and it's not just about... It may be about some kind of bottom line, you know. In the public sector, you've always got to remember you're spending taxpayers' money, and there's a responsibility with that. And there will be so much attention paid rightly on public finances. There's something as well as that, which is about the values and the way in which you do your job.
Yeah, and that's sort of it all comes back to, like, the things that don't cost anything but would vastly improve the. Yeah, the sort of relationships between people that receive public services and things.
That's right.
Yeah. Oh, that's great. Well,
you came in a nice circle then.
Yeah, I know. It's kind of all tied together perfectly.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I've taken up loads of your time now.
No, that's okay. It's okay. It's nice to talk about it, actually. Cause,
yeah.
Because you sort of write these things and then kind of go back to, you know, thinking about next week's SI or...